the latest episode of the Depot Podcast. I'm your main host for the year, William Gillis. I'm a second year history MA student at Concordia University in Montreal, looking at state ownership and the decline of the coal industry in Nova Scotia. And joining me is our French host, Fred Burrell.
Hey there.
Fred is a postdoc at Cape Breton University who looks at deindustrialization and death and dying in rural Nova Scotia. So this podcast is an initiative of Deindustrialization and the Politics of Our Time, DEPO for short, a transnational partnership of over 35 research centers, industrial museums, labor archives, trade unions, and other organizations across Italy, France, Germany, the UK, Canada, and the United States, which are six anchor countries in the project. DEPO examines the political responses to deindustrialization, as well as its historical roots and lived experiences. We can be found online at deindustrialization.org. This podcast is about highlighting the work of DEPO with monthly episodes covering a variety of topics related to deindustrialization, and we're available on all major podcast services. In today's episode, we're going to discuss the most recent DEPO annual conference held in Sydney, Nova Scotia, Canada, this past June. I'm joined by two of the organizers, Lachlan McKinnon.
Hi, everyone.
Lachlan organized the overall part of the conference. He's a professor of history at Cape Breton University and an author of a book on the collapse of the Sydney steel industry. Also joining us is Sophia Richter.
Hi there.
She is a history MA student at Concordia, along with me, and she organized the Summer Institute for Graduate Students. Sophia studies the decline of the fishing industry in New England. Welcome to the show, folks.
Pleased to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
So we'll start with you, Sophia, to talk a bit about the conference themes. Can you tell me what the DEPO Summer Institute is and what the theme this year was?
Yeah, for sure. So the Summer Institute happens every year along with the conference, and it is primarily for the student affiliates of DEPO to get together and share our research and, you know, kind of share our experiences as, you know, learning to go through the process of doing research. And so the theme this year, we chose spatial politics of deindustrialization, belonging, settler colonialism, and migration. And the inspiration for this theme was drawn from the unique regional context of Nova Scotia here in Canada. Some of these examples in Cape Breton are the uneven development, population decline, and rural resource economies.
Yeah, certainly very relevant to the history of Cape Breton and Nova Scotia in terms of deindustrialization. You were also this year a first-time attendee of the conference. What did you think of it?
Well, I thought it was a great opportunity. For many of us, it's our first time presenting in front of a large crowd. And it's also an opportunity for us to share some of our experiences, you know, challenges we face as early researchers, as well as things that we've learned. I thought I'd share just some examples that exemplify this. One was by Shauna Joyce at Queen's University Belfast, and research presentations like hers were examining some of the methodological challenges that we face as students. And her doing oral history, and, you know, she was presenting some of the challenges there with difficult groups to reach out to. And then kind of on the other end of the spectrum was Anna Bettini, who's at University of Calgary. And she was sharing some of the experiences of agricultural workers who are facing, you know, changes in the energy scapes of rural Alberta. And so, you know, she's presenting some theoretical challenges to, you know, thinking about resource economies in transition and people's experiences of that. We were hosted by Cape Breton University and Glace Bay Miners Museum, and we had a great chance to kind of take a break from all of the learning and the challenges and have a really wonderful guided tour of the local mine that was there, which was a wonderful experience to connect with someone who actually had been a miner in Sydney, Nova Scotia.
Oh, yeah. I unironically love coal mine tours. I've done so many of them.
It was really an incredible experience.
Can you also tell us a bit more about your presentation that you gave?
Well, it was also my first presentation in front of a large group of people, but I ended up actually collaborating with two other student affiliates who are all focusing on fisheries research. So we had one person from Wales, UK, and another person focusing on the Maritimes, Atlantic Canada. And so we had a great opportunity to kind of, you know, share similar theoretical challenges in geographically different places.
Nice. So Lachlan, you were the main organizer of the overall conference. Can you tell me about its theme, the politics of industrial closure?
Sure. Well, the major theme of the conference, as you said, the politics of industrial closure, is actually the first theme of the Depot project. And the idea was that we would kick off kind of one of the first times that we all came together to conclude a theme by looking at the moment of closure, right? And so throughout the week, many of the workshops and events, and indeed many of the sessions during the conference, looked at different aspects of industrial closure, from political economy to the role of the state, to even including things like kind of bottom-up protest movements or workers' activism in the face of closure announcements or once mills or mines are closed, and to really get a sense for kind of that historical moment and the kind of ripples that industrial closures across sectors produce for workers and their families, you know, in various communities.
All of these are themes that also are very related to Cape Breton as well. And in fact, you delivered a keynote lecture, which is part of Sydney's annual J.B. McLaughlin Memorial Lecture Series, and how deindustrialization and this history of working class radicalism in Cape Breton combine. So can you tell us a bit who J.B. McLaughlin was and what you talked about?
Yeah, I couldn't have been more pleased to be able to give that lecture, actually. And every year at Cape Breton University, there's an annual lecture called the J.B. McLaughlin Memorial Lecture. This was the 24th annual. And J.B. McLaughlin was a major figure in the Canadian labor movement, originally from Scotland, arrived here in the early 1920s, arrived to Cape Breton, where he found work in the coal mines, quickly became kind of an agitator for the United Mine Workers of America, pushed back against the existing kind of Provincial Workmen's Association, which was known as a company union, but the degree to which that's true has, of course, been kind of debated, you know, in historical scholarship. But nonetheless, JB kind of quickly adopted kind of a radical position and went on kind of to be viewed as kind of the leader of the Cape Breton coal miners, particularly during the years of the labor wars in the 1920s, when a variety of coal strikes between 1923 and 1925 culminated with kind of a violent confrontation that resulted in the murder of a striking coal miner by company police, and kind of set the stage for the labor the kind of labor compacts that would shape the rest of the kind of interwar and the post Second World War period. So McLaughlin is kind of firmly positioned in that history locally as kind of a major labor figure, and certainly influential in Canadian labor history as well. And so that's why the lecture is named for his contributions.
So what was actually the content of your lecture? Because you talked a bit about that.
Yeah, well, from my lecture, I really focused sort of on two moments, because in the story of, you know, in McLaughlin's life history, a lot of that history deals with conflict within the trade union movement, beginning with McLaughlin's activism kind of to turn the Cape Breton coal miners towards the United Mine Workers, and then later, of course, conflict within the United Mine Workers, with McLaughlin kind of heading up a radical faction in Cape Breton, and finding themselves stymied at various times by people like John L. Lewis and the international leadership. And so I kind of used the lecture as an opportunity to discuss that historical moment, setting up McLaughlin and Lewis and the kind of radical versus complacency kind of position within the UMW in the early 20th century. And then I expanded upon a series of events in 1981, here in Cape Breton, when a major coal strike, the first since 1947, erupted across the district, District 26. And there are many kind of echoes of the McLaughlin experience that came back around in 1981. You also saw the district leadership dissolved by an edict of the UMW International, replaced by a kind of host of other, you know, chosen leaders and appointees, and kind of a variety of conflicts that erupted between sections in that moment. And so that's kind of what I looked at in the discussion.
I would say, Lachlan, that it was particularly striking to see at the conference that quite a few of the members of the audience were at your talk were folks who had been involved in those conflicts. And, you know, they were clearly still really, really passionate about that. And, you know, had a lot to say. And I wonder, that must have been particularly nerve-wracking for you as a presenter.
It definitely was, right? Whenever you're giving a public lecture like that, you know, and, you know, we were talking about modern history in a way, right? And using oral history, a lot of the things we talk about are within living memory. And so I had a suspicion that, you know, former miners, people involved in the union movement, people who would remember 1981, right, would show up. And indeed, as Fred said, that was what happened. And yeah, you always kind of watch the audience for their reaction, right? And I was glad, I think it went quite well. But certainly in the questions afterwards, right, people were standing up and staking their place in the position. You know, I was a supporter of the UMW, or I was a supporter of the Canadian Mine Workers Union, which was a breakaway union that I talked a little bit about that came into play during that strike. But yeah, certainly it was something to consider.
Yeah, it was very interesting as well how you took those two different moments and compared them against each other, in the sense that in the 1920s you have kind of the miners' movement is kind of at its peak and at its strength, but by the 1980s the coal industry in Cape Breton is in deep decline and is fighting to hang on to what it has, as well as make advances in terms of wages and benefits. So to see these sort of two moments mirroring each other in sort of this history of like working class radicalism in Cape Breton and how that moves through these different like developments, particularly the process of deindustrialization, I thought it was a very kind of useful way to sort of approach the problem here, at least for a lecture. So Fred, I was chatting with you at the conference and you had brought up some comparisons between this year's conference in Cape Breton and the previous year's conference, which was in the Ruhr in Germany. And you were telling me a bit about the funding and sort of the transition between these two areas. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, we were so generously received and fed and housed in Sydney with the support of Cape Breton University. But all the same, it was really striking the difference in the landscape for industrial heritage work in kind of thinking about deindustrialization between the Canadian context and as you said, where we were last year or the year before, rather in the Ruhr in Bochum and in the surrounding areas, where in fact multiple sessions, both of the Summer Institute and the conference, were held in former industrial sites that have been converted through public funding into kind of massive cultural centers and museum complexes. And it was really clear that, we were in Germany, we were in a place in which, had experienced significant deindustrialization, but was, clearly still at the nerve center of global capitalism in a way that Cape Breton has not managed to be. And I think that, those kind of that contrast is indicative of the ways in which the post-industrial is lived. And so that was, that was really interesting.
Yeah, I kind of build on that point. I also found very interesting how Germany, of course, preserves all these industrial facilities as museums. And it's very wonderful and amazing to see. We went to a steel plant. We went to several different coal mines where they preserved all the surface works. None of that really exists in Cape Breton, but I kind of found the difference was there was a lot more local participation in the sort of collective memory around what had happened in Cape Breton, whereas we didn't, in my experience, didn't really encounter as much of that in the Ruhr. I mean, to be fair, I also don't speak German, but in terms of both the presentations that we got in Sydney with what we got in the Ruhr, we're a bit different. There was a different emphasis on memory. And I think in Germany, because they had all those museums, they were very interested in how do museums actually work in public memory, Whereas in Cape Breton, it's kind of kept more alive by people refusing to forget about it rather than being any museums, because all of these facilities were simply demolished in the early 2000s. So I think we should also talk a bit more about sort of Cape Breton and its relationship to deindustrialization. I mean, I guess to reveal my hand, I study Cape Breton. I'm from Cape Breton. And in fact, a lot of people in this project also study Cape Breton, kind of were very overrepresented for some reason. But the conference itself opened with a roundtable to discuss what Cape Breton is and how its deindustrialization played out. This is to explain to an audience of academics and who were from many different places in the world who may not have known very much about Cape Breton or were very familiar with its history. So several of us here on this panel right now were also on that roundtable, and I'd like to recreate it a bit for the benefit of our listeners for who couldn't attend this conference. So I'm going to throw out some questions and discussion prompts for everyone to participate in. I think the first question I should ask is, what is Cape Breton and how does it relate to deindustrialization?
Cape Breton is an island that has many, many shapes to it, right? Of course, Cape Breton is Unamagi, right? The traditional and unceded territory of the Mi'kmaq people, part of Mi'kma'ki, which it was and continues to be. And as that, it hosts a variety of memories and associations and identities. Cape Breton was also central in, you know, much of the broader history of Northeastern North America, right? Home to the French regime at Louisbourg, another set of cultural and social transitions saw it come to exist as the second largest home of Gaelic speakers outside of Scotland, with the waves of immigration following the Highland clearances in the 1800s. And then just on the tail end of that massive wave of settler colonialism and the displacement of the Mi'kmaq people, we saw the tremendous industrialization of the island, right? And with that was born, you know, Cape Breton, the industrial heart of Canada's East Coast, with its coal mines and its steel plant after 1901, and all of the associated conflicts that come with it, labor and otherwise. Now, the 20th century, you know, there was another moment of transition, right? And we saw the sort of collapse of that way of being, that kind of, and the associated, what Williams called, right, a structure of feeling. When the industries first faced crisis in the 1960s, followed by nationalization programs, coal was nationalized in Cape Breton under a Crown corporation, under the federal government of Canada. The steel industry was nationalized by the province. And then finally, in the year 2000 and 2001, those industries were closed down, leaving sort of a blank space in a way, right? And this is something that I think William mentioned earlier, which is that, you know, unlike the Ruhr, where that industrial moment has continued to characterize the perception of the region, especially among kind of the German state, you know, Stefan Berger and others work on that issue. In Cape Breton, kind of nothing really came to replace that set of kind of identities and that set of kind of economic underpinnings, right? And so instead of the Ruhr, where we have all these beautiful, you know, industrial sites that have been repurposed and that are kind of recreated in that way, here, you know, we have landscapes that are largely empty of that memory. But I do think that the cultures that were engendered by that entire process remain in various ways, which I think Fred also spoke to. So I hope that that's maybe an introduction to what is Cape Breton, and I'm sure we can take it from there.
Yeah, I think that's the helpful starting point, and sort of combining that history of resource development and sort of class conflict in the early 20th century, and then this period after the Second World War of deindustrialization. Although arguably, I think some people claim that deindustrialization in Cape Breton really begins in the 1920s as the industry enters sort of a very extended decline. And I think that leads us into this question about, I mean, Cape Breton's geographical location and particularly in relation to like the sort of central core of Canadian capitalism, which is primarily in Ontario and Quebec. Like, what does Cape Breton, I think, tell us about sort of resource peripheries and uneven development and how they feed into later deindustrialization?
I actually facilitated the panel rather than participating in it, but I think I'll just hop on here to say that one really important distinction between an industrialized yet still peripheral in terms of ownership structures and the broader kind of mechanisms of capital and industrial centers in the kind of the Canadian heartland, we can think about Montreal or in Toronto, is that they weather deindustrialization much differently. Particularly, I guess in my own doctoral research, it's been thinking about the kind of the transfer from industrial capital to real estate capital, and actually the main problem being for the working class populations that remain being gentrification, right? And it's very clear when you're in Glace Bay that gentrification has not been a phenomenon, right? And life on the resource periphery means that capital flight or capital abandonment really means abandonment in a way that urban cores don't experience.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that observation, having also lived in Montreal and Cape Breton. Although it is worth noting that currently the old industrial areas of Cape Breton are experiencing a severe housing crisis, in part brought on by like a lot of international students that the local university has brought in as part of sort of post-industrial redevelopment efforts, which it's been essentially very, very bad for all these students. But certainly this gentrification process is not really apparent in old industrial Cape Breton. And one of the, I think, compared to urban areas like Montreal or Toronto, one of the big experiences in post-industrial Cape Breton has been out-migration. I mean, personally, that is something I have done, growing up there and then leaving after high school in order, moving to Alberta eventually to find work. And I think that's sort of a very important theme, often in deindustrialization, but particularly in deindustrialized areas that are kind of on a periphery. So I think this leads us into another broader question about Cape Breton, and particularly how the island's deindustrialized experience, how does it relate to the process of deindustrialization elsewhere, and how does it differ? And I think sort of an important part of this that Lachlan has mentioned a bit is nationalization and the role of the state.
The role of nationalization and the role of the state in terms of Cape Breton's experience of deindustrialization is central to the late 20th century history, right? So we have this moment in 1966, a report called the Donald Report is released outlining the projected decline of Cape Breton coal mining. The existing coal company, the Dominion Steel and Coal Corporation, decides that they're going to wind down operations in response to a variety of things. The federal government decides to nationalize the mines, and I'm sure that Will could talk more about that particular decision, as I know it's his focus. Similarly, the next year, along a similar trajectory, the operators of the steel mill, the same company, announced the closure of the mill, followed by a provincial decision to nationalize. And then both industries, steel and coal, are run under Crown corporations until their final closure. And I think that this is, in my own work, this is kind of seen as kind of a difference of the experience in Cape Breton than in other parts of North America, where, Stephen High talks about the failure of community fight back efforts who don't rely upon like national narratives, right? Like the American versus the Canadian example. And in Cape Breton, it kind of bucks that trend because nationalization is seen as an option and it is undertaken. Now, there's a variety of ways where that is perceived, negatively as the 30 years of public ownership kind of winds on, because in neither industry were they ever significantly profitable. Certainly in the case of Sydney Steel, they weren't profitable other than the first 2 years of operations. And so very quickly elsewhere in the province, that was seen as kind of a political boondoggle, right? That decision. But in terms of its influence on the people of Cape Breton, I do think that it kind of prevented the sort of wholesale collapse that we saw elsewhere in the late 1960s and early 1970s.
Yeah, it's certainly, as you noted, this sort of state intervention and ownership is very unusual for certainly North America. And I think even for Canada, because there isn't really the same amount of nationalization that's used as a rescue. And there's sort of an interesting distinction as well between coal and steel here, because with the steel mill, the nationalization was a true rescue nationalization. It was the idea was this plant still supposedly had a future. It was a matter of eventually finding a private buyer. Whereas with the mines, it was always about closure and its replacement with like a managed closure and its replacement with something else economically. But in neither case, this never happens. They never find a private buyer for the steel plant, and the coal mines just continue on for 35 years.
Yeah. If I could just chime in once more, and I know we got to move on to other things, but I think that this is an area where in deindustrialization studies more broadly, I think we need to take a longer view of kind of the role of the state, right? Because if you look at Cape Breton in the 19th century, during the industrialization of the island as a whole, the British Empire and the British colonial state is central in that effort of organizing and centralizing industry with the creation of something called the General Mining Association, which is essentially an industrial monopoly created by a set of coal leases granted from the Duke of York in order to pay off some of his debts that he's accumulated. And so the role of the state in the industrialization of the island, and this has been written on by people like Marilyn Garrett from St. FX, really set the stage for later waves of underdevelopment and uneven development that Sophia mentioned earlier. And in some ways, I think that like the interplay between state and private actors and industrial development and deindustrialization is all part and parcel of this kind of capital flow process that we all talk about. And I think that it necessitates us, again, going beyond that idea of, okay, the state responding to deindustrialization at the moment of crisis, when in actuality, the state is kind of creating this entire set of circumstances, you know, from start to finish.
Well, Lachlan, that I think what you're saying is so interesting, and it brings that conversation of, you know, contextualizing deindustrialization in a broader, you know, timeline of political economic history. And I'd love to share just a little bit of my own reflections from being in Cape Breton, and then I have a question for you. And it goes back to my own research interest in fishing. And fishing, the fishing industry, I feel like has a good example or an interesting example of what you're saying, where you see, so I cycled the Cabot Trail with my partner. We did it in 3 days. And all along Cape Breton's Cabot Trail, which is the northwestern kind of peninsula of the two wings of the island. And there were all of these, you know, very small fishing villages everywhere. And from my understanding of the history, the recent 20th century history of commercial fishing in Northwest Atlantic, which would include, you know, all of Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, New Brunswick, and then of course, also all of New England. And in the 1990s, when the cod stocks collapsed, the response of the state, when you compare New England to Nova Scotia and the Maritimes, are pretty significant. And, you know, the interesting thing to me about studying, kind of comparing the two, is the preceding role that small communities in Nova Scotia played, having cooperatives, that there were, you know, the fishing industry, the presence of cooperatives in the Maritimes precedes the U.S. by decades. The first cooperatives, I think, were in the mid-19th century for agricultural and the fishing industry. And then you have the Antigonish movement, where, you know, cooperatives are a really important role for the development of, you know, smaller fisheries and agricultural economies in the Maritimes, which is something that New England did not have. And I'm curious if, you know, in relation to what you just said, if you could speak to the dynamic that Nova Scotia had experiencing, you know, between having these cooperative cultures in these resource development, resource economies, compared to what happens in the end of the 20th century when the state kind of reasserts its power in these in the fishing industry.
In terms of the cooperative movement in Cape Breton, I think it's an interesting story. You see things like Tompkinsville, which is the first cooperative housing movement in Canada, and that emerges, I think, in 1937 as part of that Antigonish movement that Sophia was talking about. And it's interesting because what you see is that that kind of emerges as a third way, right? It's outside of the kind of Marxist radicalism of people like J.B. McLaughlin. And instead, it's rooted in the sort of social democracy of the Nova Scotia Catholic Church, right? In Antigonish, led by people like Moses Cody and Jimmy Tompkins, who are trying to instill kind of a different vision of collective labor, rather than the one, you know, posed by some of the kind of more socialist radicals of the 1920s and 30s. Despite that, I think that that does influence the culture, right? And so you start to see cooperative housing movements are very popular. Cooperatives, I can't speak to that totally in the context of the fishery, but no, you're definitely onto something.
If this is something that interests you, Sophia, one of Nova Scotia's greatest leftist poets was a man named Kenneth Leslie, who wrote this great poem called O'Malley to the Reds, which is basically a long-form poetic debate between a Father O'Malley, who is essentially like a kind of a Moses Cody figure, and a sort of a J.B. McLaughlin figure. And actually, you know, it's the you know, the whole history of the cooperative movement in Nova Scotia, which includes, you know, not just in the fishery, but you can think of the credit union movement, kind of producers' cooperatives, the agricultural movement. In many ways, that was, as Lachlan said, a response to kind of the popularity and the actual real rooted radicalism of Marxist-Leninists, both prior to and following the development of the Communist Party of Canada. So, you know, it's in some ways it's an inspiring history to point to. And in other ways, it's a history that really served to undercut a lot of radicalism, ended up being sort of tied in with the developing CCF, which later became the NDP.
Yeah. And I also think the cooperative movement also was a bit of a response to the sort of dependency of Nova Scotia on sort of in external investment in terms of like, trying to having communities pool their money through credit unions or grocery co-ops in order to get like either better prices on their basic necessities or financial control of investment. I mean, they're as Fry pointed out, they're not necessarily that radical, but I think they're also kind of they're not that radical, but they do sort of present like a particular response to this dependency that just sort of gets worse as deindustrialization sets in.
I wondered if I could ask you a question, Sophia.
Yeah, shoot.
When you were biking around and seeing all these fishing communities, did you have a chance to talk to anybody about kind of their current experiences in the fishery here and some of the issues that they face?
I did not. I actually did not see a single person on land. We saw some boats, but yeah, the weather was really bad. It kind of rained the entire time. So there wasn't a whole lot, I think, of people just hanging out. It would be incredible to be able to speak to, people locally.
I think Sophia's sort of rained out bike trip points to sort of another sort of a final question about Cape Breton and sort of the post-industrial experience of the island, and that is tourism. And I'm thinking particularly here of the labor historian Ian Mackay's A Quest of the Folk, which looks at how tourism, which was actually very much promoted as a sort of industry to replace coal and steel in Cape Breton, also has this effect of kind of erasing the past in Nova Scotia, this past of like class conflict and industrial development and urban society, and creating instead like this image of like a sort of rural quaint folk that can be commodified for the tourists. So how do I guess the rest of you feel about that as sort of a framework for understanding or thinking about post-industrial Cape Breton, coming from either Lachlan and Fred, who are from Nova Scotia, or Sophia, who was sort of experiencing this as an outsider, almost even as a tourist?
Well, I could start just by maybe painting a scene. you cycle the Cabot Trail is something that I couldn't say exactly when it became popular to cycle it, but I've heard of, when we would be talking to cyclists, we would be talking to people who cycled it decades ago. And so this was something that draws people. And there's, it's one road that goes around this northern part of the island. And it's the part of the island that is considered to be iconic of the Scottish Highlands, for which the island was named, the region Nova Scotia was named for. And all along that route, you see signs that are in Gaelic. You see, Cayley announcements for Cayley sessions, Cayley dances or music sessions. So the Scottish heritage is it's palpable in, not only in the material kind of tourist attraction elements, but in kind of claiming the remoteness of the geography. It totally, changes your perception of it as this abandoned space to it being something that people as an outsider can come and feel fulfilled by. And so that obscures, all of the history that we're talking about. And if I hadn't been going to a deindustrialization conference in Nova Scotia, I probably would never have known, that deeper history for why, all of the glens and the highland sweeping cliffs were very much remote and unpopulated.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I think this is something that I've been reflecting more on lately, is how all of these histories play together and are intertwined and also deeply connected to questions of settler colonialism, which I know we're probably going to come to. But just thinking about the way that even among the Scottish diaspora, how certain memories and certain kind of cultural touchstones are highlighted and others are eclipsed, right? So even within that first wave of Scottish settlement in the early 1800s, there would have, and indeed in the poetry of the Gaels, there is a deeply anti-landlord, kind of early anti-capitalist, some might argue, sense that resulted from the expulsion during the Highland clearances. It's just the case. However, once arriving in Nova Scotia, in this part of the world, the aspects of Highland identity that instead were cemented in the landscape here are the ones that Sophia mentioned, right? The names, some of the language on the signs, certain aspects of tartan culture and kind of elite Highland culture was kind of seen as the dominant lens through which that type of community can be viewed. However, I do think that there's different ways in which all of these cultures, from Mi'kmaq to Scottish to Acadian after their expulsion, kind of converge together in this part of the world and do kind of contain an underlying kind of radical sensibility in very broad terms.
Yeah, and I think there's an interesting perspective on this in deindustrialization, because in my current research, looking at this state-owned enterprise that took over all of the coal mining, is this company actually does a kind of Cape Breton nation building in its attempt to foster alternative economic development. As I mentioned, tourism was sort of a big part of this. And you can see it, one of the sort of famous or infamous or schemes it got into was airlifting hundreds of Scottish sheep to Cape Breton to kickstart a sheep farming industry in the 1970s. It doesn't really work out for a variety of reasons that we won't get into, but if you're interested, Will Langford has a very good paper on this. But the company produces this this half-hour documentary, which you can find on YouTube, called Song of the Seasons from 1977, which creates this image of Cape Breton. It's like very Highland Scottish and like quaint and rural, and doesn't really make any mention of like this industrial history or really anyone else other than like this sort of Scottish, Highland Scottish settlers. And it does lead to these interesting, or I guess these issues also around like settler colonialism and the Mi'kmaq people, where Mi'kmaq people had not only been dispossessed for like the construction of this industrialization in the early 20th century, but also are impacted by like closure in the late 20th century. And you can find internal archival documents where indigenous reserves are interested in participating in some of these redevelopment programs, particularly around fishing and oyster farming. And the Crown Corporation basically says it's not our mandate outside of our jurisdiction and just kind of leaves it there, which is this sort of interesting, I guess there's this example of how even in this transition away from an industrial economy, we get like all these different erasures of different groups in Cape Breton and like the construction of a particular identity to try and replace this industrial one that existed before. So kind of as our final like section of this episode, we're going to talk a little bit about the panels that were presented there and what, and it was a large variety of them. I think generally this, as the second year of the conference, I think there was a lot more interesting panels in some senses because of sort of the collaboration and cross-pollination that was developed in the first conference as we all got to know each other, that has paid dividends since then as people have like worked together often like transnationally. I'd like to ask, or I get people to tell me a little bit about sort of panels they were interested in, like generally related to my research interests. I liked how many panels in this year were actually about the role of the state and all the different perspectives coming from a variety of different countries. So if anyone wants to jump in and talk about their favorite panels, go ahead, please.
I can say for myself, I was really excited in general about the fact that so many of the presentations were moving towards kind of the political economy of deindustrialization. You know, I guess industrial closures lends itself to that lens. But, you know, in past, deindustrialization studies has been heavily memory focused, heavily oral history structured. And we've, you know, sometimes we sort of like lose sight of the forest for the trees, the forest being capitalism. So I was really glad that capitalism seemed to be back on the agenda.
So going perhaps in the opposite direction, as Fred was sharing, I think in addition to some of the, you know, getting into the complexities of the political economic dynamics that we're studying, I thought that the presentations that expressed the humanization of the political was also very generative. And perhaps as a, you know, a student in research, we don't get exposed to nearly as many kind of multidisciplinary forms of research. And so I wanted to share two presentations that did that in a way that to me was quite eye-opening. And both of them engaged with themes of thinking about the working class, this heterogeneous body, through the lens of the precariat, in doing so in humanizing ways. So the first that I wanted to share was one of our keynote presentations was Magdalena Novoa Esharin from the University of Illinois. And her presentation was called "We Were Replaced by Pines, Dispossession, Displacement, and the Colonial Wound in Pilpilco's Coal Mine Closure." And she worked with a community who had been very much grounded in this coal plant. And, you know, as the title would indicate, after its closure was abandoned. And there is this, you know, underlying politics of dispossession and displacement that this community loses the place where they belonged. And so she works with them and works with their memories in recreating a sense of place and a sense of belonging through textiles. And actually like visualizing the community that they lived in, which I thought was just really beautiful in thinking about, you know, working through the trauma of these politically, you know, significant experiences that these people had. And then the second one was one of the artists in residence of Depot's residency program that happens every year. And this one was by the Italian artist Francesca Marsoni. And her work, the project works to bring workers in dialogue with the archives and of workers' lives. And so these workers were able to go in and select photographs, images that resonated with them. And she was able to kind of visualize or reimagine those workers through her art, visual art, in order to, yeah, to consider these situations of fragility, isolation, and marginalization that precarious workers experience.
For my part, I loved Wenqi's discussion of deindustrialization in the Chinese Rust Belt. I thought that her work is just so illustrative of what Depot is setting out to do, thinking about deindustrialization across borders, thinking about different ways of periodizing deindustrialization, considering different types of state approaches. I very much enjoyed that paper. And it was just really interesting to have a chance to talk to Wen and find, you know, connections between research that you would never expect. Like when we were at the Miners Museum together, we talked to Cassandra Spooner Lockyer, who was working at the museum, who was telling us about a tour that the Men of the Deeps took of China in the 1970s, and they were presented with kind of this painting of Norman Bethune and Mao. And just, you know, the idea that this miners' choir from Cape Breton would be touring industrial sites in China, and that we have the chance to kind of talk to one another about what that might mean and what those sort of cultural encounters might have looked like, was just a really interesting kind of discussion. And so I think that as we move forward, kind of increasingly making this a global project is something that that I think is really worthwhile.
Oh yeah. Like seeing a lot more presentations from outside of the sort of six anchor countries was very good, particularly looking at the global South, which is often not something that's discussed in the context of deindustrialization. It instead often it's presented as like where this sort of industry went, but these areas are also experiencing these same cycles of investment and disinvestment. Sort of, I'd also like to give a shout out to the Glace Bay Miners Museum, where part of our conference was held. It was the most torqued, like pro-worker mining museum I've ever been to. And honestly, over the last year, I've been to a lot of coal mining museums in Alberta, in Wales, Germany. And it was just like absolutely wild how much this like centered on working class experience compared to other places. I mean, like, It was quite special for me. So this kind of concludes our recap of the Sydney conference, which I hope people found useful, even if it wasn't totally comprehensive. I recommend looking actually at the program, which is freely available, again, on our website at deindustrialization.org. And you can see the huge breadth of research that's being done by DEPOE. Next year, the DEPOE conference will be held at the end of June 2024 in Belfast in Glasgow, which should be very, very interesting. The exact details have not yet been released, but you can go to our website and you can sign up for our monthly newsletter, which will announce them, as well as any other news about the DEPOE project. These conferences are open to the public and they're free to attend, and they include many more activities than just paper presentations. We had a special private concert from the Men of the Deeps in Sydney that was very, very wonderful, where they sang a songs about closure. And it was all around a very emotional experience for everyone. I mean, I'm certainly looking forward next year to seeing Red Clydeside in Glasgow and the sort of history of its working class radicalism and what happens to it in the process of deindustrialization. Do folks have any other highlights they're interested in seeing in Belfast and Glasgow?
So just say the theme itself for the conference is around the second research stream of the DEPOE project, which is around gender and deindustrialization. So it's going to be really great to be bringing in that new perspective now that we've kind of done industrial closures, and we'll be moving into a kind of a serious discussion about the gendered impacts of capital flight. And so I'm looking forward to that conversation, and it's always great to be back in the UK, and that's something that we've been able to maintain over the last couple of years, the kind of the crossovers between our oral history work in Canada and the Scottish Oral History Centre. And so it'll be great to see folks again.
I think the last time I was in Glasgow was in 2018, and we did a full kind of walking tour of the waterfront with Arthur McIver and Andy Clark and some of these people who've been working on deindustrialization and masculinity and some of these questions. And at the time, it seemed like they were really experiencing kind of a wave of major gentrification, right? Which, of course, as we said, is different from what we see here in Cape Breton. And so just to get a sense for now, you know, several years later, just to see those changes in the landscape is something that I'm looking forward to.
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to more bagpipes. but you know, it's going to be a great opportunity, you know, as student affiliates, you know, many of us who are here for many years and some of us for only a couple, to be able to reconnect and to meet new folks, who are joining the DEPOE this year. And that's always a very generative experience.
Oh yeah. I mean, these are conferences are very enjoyable to go to, and I believe there is a plan in the works to record a number of the presentations next year and release them as part of the DEPOE podcast. So hopefully for those who can't attend, we'll have even better than just a recap episode next year. So from everyone here at DEPOE, thank you for listening, and I hope you'll tune into our next episode coming in a month. I encourage people to go and check out our previous episodes that we've already done, hopefully you'll look forward to many more. So thank you and goodbye.